It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got absolutely loads to talk about today. There's the high performance review into men's cricket. We've got the mother of all Mancad debates after Deepti Sharma's controversial run out of Charlie Dean at Lord's. Surrey win the county championship with a round to spare. And it turns out that seven match bilateral T20I series can actually be really good. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Mark Butcher will be joining us later in the show to talk about both the high performance review and the England-Pakistan series. But let's start with the high performance review. On Thursday, the ECB released the final recommendations from that review into men's cricket. They made 17 recommendations. Quite a few of them aren't actually that contentious. More Lions first-class cricket to give players more experience overseas before playing test cricket. Trialling the use of Kookaburra balls that do less than Duke's balls in the county championship. An annual North versus South series, but also proposing a different-looking domestic schedule with a window for an FA Cup-style one-day cup involving the minor counties in April. A reduced county championship fixture list down from 14 games a season to 10 games a season with a top division of six above two parallel second divisions. The Blast will also see a reduction in fixtures, again down from 14 to 10. The 100 remains untouched and the championship will be played in May, June, April and September. Some counties have already voiced their concern over the proposals. Kent Chair Simon Phillips said, "We will not allow our club to be rendered irrelevant." Phil, is the reduction in games the main point that counties have an issue with? Is that why there's been this reaction? Because I've been quite surprised by it, because a lot of the stuff that's been discussed has kind of been out there for a lot of the summer already.
I think that's a large part of the first part of the conversation, sure. But it feels like it is at the start of a long conversation. This is the beginning of a slowly evolving change in the landscape rather than the end point, I think. In the short term, certain counties are terrified of losing four Blast games, two of which will be at home, two of which, of course, would severely impact their revenue streams. There is the additional concern, of course, that losing four four-day matches across the course of the season doesn't necessarily impinge on the finances of a county, the vast majority of counties, and in fact, if we are going to put some parenthesis on this, it might even help them alleviate some of their financial strains if you were to lose a couple of these games. However, and this is where it gets muddier, and this is where it gets more about what county cricket stands for and the values of county cricket, if you were to pull those games out with this restructure, then that means that the people who are a part of the flora and fauna of county cricket, the people who enable this thing to maintain some kind of identity in an ever-changing world, they will be robbed of the thing that they love the most. And while it's a spurious point how much power members have in individual county clubs, nonetheless, they provide so much of the oxygen of what a county club is. 15 of the 18 clubs are purportedly, at least, meant to be members' clubs, driven and run by the members. The members hold sway, purportedly. And yet, the overall number of members across the country has been slowly reducing over time. You could now get the full number, aggregate number of members across all the 18, you could get them into Spurs' stadium and still have a few thousand left over. A rough number is about 55,000 now. It's come down from 70,000 from a few years back, only partially due to COVID. So it is an interesting and key point how much sway members actually have in the shakedown of this review. And how much do these members, many of whom I know, I've been a member myself of my own club, and they are invariably people who are absolutely enthralled and in love to the thing that gives their life so much meaning. And we dismiss or become high-handed at our own peril of these people. But how much are they truly reflective of people who are interested in county cricket, and crucially, people who pay money to go and watch county cricket, where overwhelmingly you have a white ball audience these days, and that this is where the direction of travel is taking us, at least in theory. The 50 over cricket has to be maintained, for example, despite the fact that it's been sidelined, it still has to be maintained. 10 blast games is a reduction, but it's still 10 blast games. And the counties will be begging. I think in the end, the counties, the compromise that will be reached, I think the biggest compromise that will be reached, and why I think overall these recommendations will get over the line with a bit of back and forth, will be those four games. So in a long-winded answer to your question, in the short term, yeah, counties need and want as many blast games as they possibly can, because that's their financial oxygen. But the fear, the existential fear that this is the starting point and the end point will be the squeezing and eventual reduction of the 18-county model is a valid and legitimate concern, I think. I would also add, very briefly, if I can, county cricket has been buffeted for a century and more. I found a book written in the early 50s that I was looking at the other week, talking about the eventual death of county cricket, the eventual death of the 17-club model as it was then, and how people's behaviours have changed and evolved and no longer reflect modern society, and that county cricket is an anachronism. This was in 1956, I think it was, this book. So that's been the narrative for a long, long, long time, but it does feel like now all of these strands, and it's impossible to tie it in, it's such a difficult thing to try and sum up, especially on a podcast on a Monday morning. But all of these strands feel like they are now, they're now being pulled and pushed ever more so. And that we are reaching a moment of reckoning, I think, with the overall structure of our game.
Yeah, and it's remarkable as well, because in some ways the County Championship is almost the most unchanged, one of the most unchanged sporting competitions in the world, right? Since its inception, it's sure the number of games gone up and down a bit. It's gone to two divisions. It's been 3 days, 4 days, but they've added one team in 50 years, and that's all that's happened. I think it's interesting you mentioned the word compromise there, because like Yaz said, I was surprised by the strength of the reaction to this, by the number of county chairs who were willing at this point to sort of put their heads above the parapet in the way to stop towing the ECB line and saying, we have proper issues with this. And obviously Kent's went the furthest, but there were lots sort of voicing their concerns. But then I was also surprised by the amount of reduction that the ECB was suggesting. And that actually wasn't what was being sort of teased in the build-up to it. So I don't think there was much discussion of the T20 blast being cut short. And that feels like a real realisation of fears which county fans have been suggesting for a long time, that the 100 would be brought in, ECB would pay lip service to saying, you know, the T20 blast is going to be maintained as the premier T20 competition in the country, the 100 will be a different thing that will allow it to stand on its own. But then sideline the T20 Blast quietly, which is what has happened this year. They've put it into a schedule which has been kind of unworkable for it from a marketing point of view, and that's led to a reduction in ticket sales, and then that almost allows you to justify cutting short the number of games. So I do wonder if the ECB, if this is just, basically if this is a deliberate first position, basically they weren't expecting to push this over the line, which might well work. It might well be that they end up getting away with something like a 10 game county championship and a 14 game T20 Blast, but that will also come at a cost to a relationship between the counties and the ECB. I think that there's been at least a veneer of sort of a collaboration in this, and that the ECB is saying, you know, this high performance, we want to involve the whole game in this, we want to be talking to everyone, we want to be bringing people along with us. For the ECB then to put forward this as basically an oppositional move to say, you know, this is the thing, and then be like, actually, we'll go up to this if you let us have this other thing. That's maybe a pragmatic move, but it could well come with consequences down the line.
It's hard. You're absolutely right, and it's hard to shake the sense that this is the first shot in an ideological battle.
But sorry, is it just ideological? I think it's pragmatic. Strauss's warning of what's coming. He, in an interview with the Vaughan and Tuffers podcast and the Telegraph, he said players will vote with their feet eventually. They want to play less cricket. I know people like Ben Stokes have said that he wants 14 games in the championship, but he's played 3 cricket matches in the last 10 weeks. Players want to play less cricket. They keep saying that.
Can I say something on this? Sorry.
Yeah, I was also going to mention, sorry, just the looming threat of private investment in the 100. Surely, when you have private investment in, they're going to want more of that. So these suggestions have been made with that in the background. So I think it's pragmatic as well as ideological.
And there are elements in which I have sympathy with the ECB, because it is a thankless and basically unsolvable problem. The PCA released a statement about what their players' committee wanted, and if I just read out what the 6 key fundamentals they want, it's retaining an 18 county first class system, fine. Greater emphasis on the county championship played in the height of summer, not alongside the 100, fine. Maintaining elite T20 competition, okay. Reinstating a Premier 50 over competition, okay. Growth of the 100, okay. And then finally, overall reduction in the amount of cricket played.
How many cakes can you eat at once?
So from that point of view, like, that there isn't going to be a solution that satisfies everyone, sure. And I do agree that the private investment thing is the thing that is unspoken, but will be increasingly more spoken of. And that will be another sort of watershed moment, will be when someone who is actually employed in a position of power says, this is something we are actively considering. And that might not be, it might be in a couple of years' time. And it might also be that they consider it and they find that the market isn't out there as well. But that's the next key, whether you want to call it ideological or pragmatic, that's the next key debate to be had, I guess, which is part of this one, I suppose.
Back to the actual suggestions. Yeah. I don't really mind a lot of it. I don't mind playing first class cricket that's not the championship in August. I think that's better than what we currently have. For me, it doesn't make a massive difference if it's championship cricket or first class cricket. I think people
would
enjoy.
What would you prefer if you had a choice?
So
on the table being, yeah, say, 2 to 3 rounds of championship cricket as part of the, obviously, the overall championship in the middle of August, or festival cricket as it's being sort of euphemistically described, i.e. you hope for the best that Lancashire and Yorkshire put on a Roses game at Southport, and maybe Essex and Kent play, and maybe Surrey and Middlesex or whatever, etc., etc. So what would you prefer to see? What has more integrity as well?
I think I'd marginally prefer just playing the championship then, because counties, particularly the big ones, are just used to losing loads of players at once anyway. Surrey win the championship playing 22 players, regularly have lost players to both the England Test and White Ball squads at the same time, and they manage. I know a county like Somerset, who lose, I think, 12 to the 100, would really, really struggle.
I'm of the opposite view. I would prefer the county championship to maintain as much integrity as possible.
And you don't mind, I'm just playing the advocate here, you don't mind there being basically an 8 to 10 week gap in the middle where you almost forget who's done well and who's done badly, and then you pick it up at the fag end of the season. You're okay with that?
I mean,
when phrased like that,
yeah.
It's not ideal, but...
No, it's not ideal, but I think that's just about the compromise I would rather, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll answer my own question for what it's worth. I would be really sad to see it reduced to 10 games, albeit with a playoff at the end. I would like to see 14 games, or certainly around that mark, and I would like it played throughout the season, and I would be more comfortable with the county championship being played, albeit in the shadow of the 100 in August, than these slightly convoluted, slightly peculiar, meaningless, albeit first-class, stamped exhibition games in August. I don't think people will care. I think that players will be falling over each other not to feature in it. It will be feeder cricket, i.e. twos cricket, with a sprinkling of ones players who haven't played well, who want to keep their hand in and want to fight for a contract following year. But I think it will be broadly meaningless cricket. But I think I would prefer to see the county championship, albeit denuded of certain players, I would prefer to see the county championship spread across the season with 14 games, maintained because you are using August. And for sure, there will be howls of protest from teams such as Surrey, for whom they are severely hamstrung by the 100, for sure. But the gap between the haves and the have-nots in English cricket is so vast now, and increasingly so, that one of the unintended consequences of the 100 would be that you would get a levelling of the playing field across those months. Across those weeks, rather, in August. And the reality is, for a club like Surrey, they've gone and won the league and done it remarkably well. And they've often fielded a mixture of twos and less heralded ones players and still gone and won the league. That is the nature of being a county side these days, where you are having players who are pulled hither and thither, whether it's for a 100 side or the Lions or, of course, for England, whatever it may be. The pros of playing championship cricket outweigh the pros of playing festival cricket, and the pros of playing some form of Red Bull cricket outweigh the pros of playing none, for me personally, in August.
So one other thing that they could do, I suppose, if you're worried about the standard of those games, would be to have those be sort of regional games of some sort, so you have fewer teams playing those games, which will mean stronger overall, because that was one of the things in that first bit of the review they did, was the number of first class players, the best first class players that don't play in the 100. So it's only, what, 30% of the best ones that do. So that's enough to really diminish an 18 team competition, but it's also few enough that if you condense the team slightly, right, you could have something pretty high quality. You might want to get 10 teams, maybe. I mean, that means you get to spread it to less places festival wise, but you might be able to get, you know, if you're doing a sort of, if you've got 3 weeks of games, then you can hop around the country, you end up covering, what would that be, 15 grounds? That's not awful,
and
I suppose.
And more than any other element of the English season, the county championship exists for your diehards, and all power to them, right? But the county championship forever has been pulled here and there, hither and thither, by the more commercially viable elements of the county season, right? So this might be a more extreme version of it, but it's something that clubs are very used to and members are used to. And if we are truly valuing the rank and file, the diehards who get out there from spring to autumn, then surely, especially those for whom there are no 100 games to watch at their local clubs, their local grounds, or for whom they are ideologically opposed to the 100, you're still giving them some version of valid cricket.
On individuals rather than counties, I think one thing that's quite interesting from the proposal is that individual players who don't yet have white ball contracts, T20 contracts around the world, don't have 100 gigs, probably end up playing more first-class cricket than they did before. So someone like Ryan Patel at Surrey, who's not playing for England yet, who's not got 100 contracts, he'll play in whatever they play in August. But he also will play, or someone like him could play in the North versus South stuff before the season. And there's going to be more Lions first-class cricket as well. So for an individual basis, you might have some players who don't play for England who play up to 17, 18 first-class matches a year. And just going back to, I think there are two almost fundamental questions underlying this all. One, since when has county championship been about solely about high performance?
Right, it's a way of life, isn't it?
And then two, what you talked about at the start, I think there'll be some people listening to this being like, why do county members have this much power? They are an unrepresentative group of people of those who love cricket in the country. There are so many people who pay a lot of money to watch the 100, who watch England play, who don't care about county cricket at all. And I know county members listening to this might not like that, but it's true. There are a lot of people who pay a lot of money to follow English cricket who have no say at all.
As I said, you know, it is a moot point. How much power, 55,000 across an 18-club game, should be afforded? It is a key question, which is why I kind of suggested it's hard not to see some kind of ideological scrap here. I mean, David Hopps, the brilliant David Hopps, who is Cricket Info's long-standing observer of county cricket, you know, and nobody sees it more clearly than him. One of the all-time great lines, by the way, in his Cricket Info piece: county members are revolting. Well, the ECB have been saying that in private for years. I mean, what a great opening. Worth reading for a really cogent analysis of this very, very difficult question.
Obviously, it's 20 minutes at the start of the podcast isn't going to do this all justice. So in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to do a longer piece on the pod on the High Performance Review, talking to people in the county game about their views and give them real space to articulate exactly what they think about the review and voice their short-term and medium-term fears of what it means for the county game.
Could I just add one last thing before we move on? Richard Thompson is the new ECB chairman or chair, and he is very well respected within the game. He's credited with doing great stuff at Surrey during his chairmanship. He's walked into this storm, and he will need all his sort of powers of diplomacy and urbanity, if you like, to deal with the competing challenges here. But he is seen by 100 haters as sort of ideologically aligned to their cause. So he has credit in the bank on that side of things. But he's also seen as progressive and very much of the modern world, who made his money and his reputation in the entertainment business as well. So he's used to dealing with, you know, ego characters and so on. So he's also said, crucially, and this echoes Surrey's position, that Red Bull cricket should not be allowed to be diminished any further. He said that 2 or 3 years ago, and that was his line in the sand when he was Surrey chair. So it would be very, very interesting as the lobbying begins. And again, just to specify, 12 of the 18 need to agree to whichever final garbled version of these recommendations are passed through. And Thompson has a big, big job ahead of him. But the ECB, almost by accident, having sort of gone round the houses to try and find somebody to do the job, and they've landed, I think, on probably the best person for the job. And it'll be really, really intriguing, I think, to see how, what role he can play as he tries to sort of kettle them together and get some sort of consensus across a game that's not really renowned for much.
Well, let's head to Mark Butcher to hear what he thinks of the review and also the second, third and fourth Pakistan-England T20s.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Mark, there's been a lot of quite impassioned reaction to the release of the High Performance Review and all the recommendations that came with it. What were your initial thoughts to Andrew Strauss and co recommended?
If you were to do everything that it suggests, I don't think you'd ever get it through. I mean, you need what? Two-thirds majority, don't you, in terms of the counties and their members to kind of go for it. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. And I think it's one of those situations whereby Strauss and co have had to throw a lot of things at the wall, and just to see, you know, knowing that some of them were never going to fly and that others might just get through. At the moment, until there are some sort of concrete ideas as to, okay, this is how it's going to look and this is why we are doing this. You know, the two pillars of the whole thing are, funnily enough, the 100, which is not really anything to do with high performance at all. It's to do with making cash and having eyeballs on the sport, and perhaps even being able to sell the product on at some point to private equity. And the other one is of course the county championship, which is about county championship is about sort of, you know, all the historical factors that go along with that, but it's also about producing cricketers for England, and will be and will still be that no matter how you dress it up going on into the future. So it's those two things are the pillars, and the other things that move in and around them are kind of, those are the pieces that are supposed to be high performance. But the two things that kind of get in the way of all of that running more smoothly and being more cohesive, I suppose, are the two main things: 100 on the one hand, county championship on the other.
You played county cricket after your England career for a few years. A lot of England players finish playing cricket, professional cricket, full stop when they finish. You continue playing. How do you view the county championship and county cricket as a whole being viewed through the lens of high performance to this degree?
Well, I played my last game in 2009, but seasons, because I was out for most of 2005 with the wrist thing, but seasons 2006, 2007 and half of 2008, they were pretty successful ones for me personally. But they were also a reminder of what it is to be a county player, which is that you are, it's an endurance test. It's not a skill test. By the time I was back in the county ranks by then, and my England career was over, I was an experienced enough player to be able to run on fumes, to be able to kind of go out there and do things on autopilot, and be good enough to kind of be able to take care of myself without because I'd done it for so long, you know. For young players, and I think this is one of the issues that the players have, and the PCA have reported that, you know, the ones who are sought after to play and everything are pulled from pillar to post. They never have any time to prepare and to rest and to get themselves into a state where they are sort of somewhere close to 90% ready to go out and play. And in the end, it takes its toll. And that's where high performance kind of disappears out the window. And that's always been the case with county cricket. County cricket has always done that. You know, I'm sorry to say that to the members and whatever, because we're talking from two different sides of the fence. The players would like to be kind of, you know, to be given the opportunity to be at their best more often than not. And county schedules, not just this one, but going back to when I started in 1992, have never, ever been about that at all. Never. And, you know, England's success over a period of time, starting around about the turn of the century, began when players started being removed from county cricket. Now, back then, players didn't have the choice. You know, players didn't have the choice to remove themselves to go and earn money doing something else. You know, it was kind of like, be good enough to get a central contract and play for England, or that was it. Those were the choices you had. But now the players have a myriad of choices, so many other things that they can do, and sort of being dragged around from pillar to post and kind of feeling as though the game starts to become drudgery rather than something that you're excited about is an option that they don't have to face anymore. And there is there's a massive difference, a huge difference in where the sort of balance of power lies between players and their employers, and, you know, the boards who are trying to put together schedules for players to play, and that therein lies the huge issue for everybody. You cannot ignore the voice of the players in this anymore. You used to be able to. You used to be able to just tell them, you've signed on the dotted line, get on with it. But they don't have to take that anymore. And so therefore, something slightly more cunning and slightly more representative of kind of the realities of the modern game needs to be brought in.
Moving on to the Pakistan-England series, one specific question. There's one guy in the England World Cup squad who's not played the T20 of any description for well over a year. He hasn't played for England in 18 months. Ben Stokes, he's not out there in Pakistan. How does he fit into that first choice team with all these young batters
doing well, Harry Brook in and Ben Duckett in the middle order. And okay, Alex Hale isn't young, but he's done well in his return up at the top.
Yeah, I've got no idea, actually. I mean, I think Ben kind of poses a problem that the captain and the coach and the management of that team could probably do without. You know, Harry Brook at the moment is playing on a different level. Hales has been brought in to do exactly what Alex Hales has been doing for the last 3 years, which is to be an absolute menace to opposition bowlers at the top of the order. You know, England's other options there have been wiped out. And so, you know, Hales Butler at the top is pretty much nailed on as far as I can see it. And then it's a question of, you know, Liam Livingstone, presumably fit, is going to be there on the team sheet. Moeen Ali will be there on the team sheet, you would imagine, in some capacity. Although I suppose in Australia, his option with the off spin perhaps isn't quite as potent as it might be in other places. So maybe there is the sort of, you know, there's the tipping point. Does Stokes' role as an all rounder trump Moeen Ali's in Australia? Are those two kind of vying for a position of floater between, you know, four and six or whatever? Because it's almost impossible to see them leaving or being able to leave Harry Brook out, particularly when you think that the game time that guys are going to have leading into it now. Joss, I think, is going to play in all three matches in Lahore, but that might not be correct. He seemed to be fit enough as far as I could tell. And then, you know, so he and Hales have got to bat together. That partnership needs to kind of find its feet. You know, Milan is going to be in there at number three, you would imagine, despite having a little bit of a quiet time in this series so far. And so it doesn't leave a lot of room, does it, for Ben? So yeah, interesting. It's very, very interesting. And you kind of thinking to yourself, well, England have kind of had an opportunity here with all of these matches in Pakistan. But the opportunity has been for a lot of players who are not even in the squad. So you would think that Joss Butler would want to be playing pretty much his full strength team between now and that first game, you know, six matches in slightly different conditions. But he might not get the chance to do that as yet because, you know, they're still nursing Mark Wood. Chris Wokes hasn't bowled a ball in anger for ages. And, you know, he was sort of just about off a full run in practice prior to the match on Sunday in Karachi. So, you know, there are Chris Jordan's not out here yet. He will be joining up in Australia. So there are so many moving parts for England at the moment that it's starting to look a bit of a mess. you know, they're still very capable of playing extraordinary cricket. And, you know, Mark Wood the other night was thrilling. Harry Brook has been magnificent throughout the course. But you're also thinking to yourself, there's not been a cohesive performance yet. And of course, you don't want to peak too early, but it'd be nice to be somewhere close or to have some sort of an idea that you're just about to be in peaking mode. When at the moment, England are in just about at the point where they can think about perhaps putting what might be their best 11 on the park, but not quite get round to doing it.
Yeah, quite. It might have been in conversation with you, but before the start of the series, Joss Butler said on Sky that he kind of viewed this World Cup as a free hit, given how early it was in their cycle, which I was surprised by, given how established a lot of that team is in white ball cricket, and that not that long ago, a year ago, a World Cup semi-final defeat was disappointing. So to describe a World Cup a year later as a free hit, it's quite interesting and an interesting glimpse into how the dressing room might be thinking at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's, you know, you say something like that in order to take pressure off yourselves or whatever. But I mean, if it was really being viewed like that, then you probably wouldn't be bringing Ben Stokes along, would you? Or you might just say, well, we're going to go with Salt and not bother with Hales. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't be so keen to be carrying around these 30 something injured players if it was just, you know, let's throw all the youngsters in there and, you know, we'll have a proper tilt at it in 2 years' time. So, there are conflicting messages there. I'm not having a go at them for it, but it seems to me if that's truly the way you're viewing this World Cup, then you might have, selection-wise, you might have been a little bit more gung-ho with some of the young'uns and left some of the old'uns behind.
Well, cheers for your time, Mark. We'll catch you next week.
Ben, let's start with the second T20I. There was a lot of chat about Rizwan and Babba's strike rate at the top, but their unbeaten stand of 203 was so good to watch. And I think over the course of the first four games, we've got an idea of why they bat the way they do. Their middle order really has struggled quite often. Do you now see why they have been more cautious in the last year or so? Combination of not only the batting line, but having a really strong bowling attack that will back themselves to defend par if they're batting first?
It's quite a leading question there. To be honest, yes and no still, I think. Obviously, that partnership was incredible. And when it comes off, it is incredible to watch as much as it is, you know, anything else. Like that they see themselves as kind of their team's only hope. So they do risk a lot. Like it's low risk batting in a way, in that any particular delivery they're not like to get out. But also, if either of them had been dismissed between overs like 7 and 15, Pakistan lose that game quite comfortably, and there would well be blame coming their way for it. But I also think it's there's two strands to it. One is that might the middle order be a bit stronger if they got a bit more time in the middle approaching different situations. That's one question. The other thing as well, I think it is a bit easy to overestimate just how weak the rest of Pakistan's batters are. I mean, Shah Masood's half century in the third T20I was very good. We've seen him in county cricket throughout this year. He's a batter in their mould, but if you have three of them, or even they might be able to find another, then actually each of them can go a little bit harder. You also have Asif Ali, who's this eight ball a game specialist who hits sixes for fun, and his innings really in the fourth T20I ended up being the difference with what, two sixes and three balls in the game they win by three runs. So I do understand it more than, say, if Butler and Hales were playing that way, it would be even weirder with the strength and depth that England have. But I also think that they could stand to attack a little bit more, I suppose. And that, you know, for all that performance was amazing, two games before it, Rizwan had played scored a half century, which you could justifiably call match losing. They were chasing 171, I think, in the Asia Cup final. He scored something like 55 or 49. Like that is a bad T20 innings, whether you have no middle order or not. That's just a bad innings. And then even yesterday, obviously, that's the strength of the bowling attack and of this, you know, this Pakistan side, who really are all playing for each other. That was the other striking thing about that second T20I, is how so many of their teammates not just said well done to them, but made a point of sort of hitting back at the critics, like Shaheen tweeting like, look how selfish these two are, with a wink face sort of thing. They really do all play for each other, and that is going to get them far as well. Even before that yesterday, you could still say that, you know, they faced what, like about 75% of the balls yesterday, and they just could have gone a bit earlier, I guess.
Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Harry Brook, really. It's got to be. What an innings. 80 odd off 35 balls. All of the audacity and cheek and raw brilliance that you want to see from a young kid. But it's really underpinned with all the kind of orthodoxy as well that you're also looking for from a player that has been earmarked for a while to do interesting things in the game, but has clearly now been... they are preparing for him to be the full package, the multi-format player, and he, which is vanishingly rare these days, will have a bid to become that player. It was just, yeah, sensational. I haven't watched it back, but there are a couple of shots that stick in my mind. There was one straight drive which went over the sight screen with a check on it, and the balance is always so clear. You know, he's moving from laterally across the crease, opening up the offside. He plays a lot more through the offside than maybe your identikit 21-year-old, 22-year-old white ball kid. You know, there's a lot more going on outside off stump than there is, say, with Liam Livingston, for example. So he is compulsively watchable, but it's all grounded in the stuff that I understand, if that makes any sense. There's all the funk, there's all the fun of the fair with him. Of course there is, but it's grounded in technical sense and proficiency, and it's got that perfect, lovely little kind of alchemy of cheekiness alongside, obviously, technical brilliance.
Shieldberry in the Telegraph described him as England's first true 360-degree player. And my initial reaction is like, what? Butler's been around for a while. He described it as he can hit 360-degree both on the ground and in the air, and that his wrists allow him to play more shots than Butler can, basically. I was thinking with Brook, and I've mentioned it a few times in the show, I can't believe England didn't play him more in the summer across all formats, to be honest. Cricket's got this weird thing with batters, not quite with bowlers, where imagine the England football team, right, and you've got this guy who's scoring loads and loads of goals in the Champions League. You get him in the team regardless. Whereas in cricket, you can only bring someone into a top six if there's someone failing in the top six, no matter how good that guy on the outside is. Harry Brook is so good. I don't understand why England haven't been quicker to move, get him in, particularly Test cricket, to be honest. Because
But how difficult is it when you've got 3, 4, 5, 6 sewn up? You've got the best young player at 3, someone who's got serious Red Bull runs behind him. And then you've got the best player in the world at 4. You've got a player who's had
the most informed player in the world,
and then the best all-rounder at 6. So, what do you do?
I think at the start of the summer, I would have played him and given Best of the gloves. I think, and it's difficult.
There's a question about predictions, wasn't there? You know, I mean, I made that prediction up there, so I should play that first test match. Albeit he didn't score runs, but he did okay from there on. Yeah. So that was a big black mark against me. But yeah, look, from his position, he'd have been itching to get in there. But I don't think it's that bad a thing. In the long term, really, you know, he's around that setup. There's a lot more cricket to come. I like the fact that they have not tried to silo him, right? Not said, all right, well, you know, you can prioritise that stuff or that stuff. I like the fact that they've looked at him early on and thought, all right, you've got the full range here. And so we're going to give you, over the next 5 years, the chance to become that full package cricketer. The player he reminds me of, I don't know if this has been said on commentary, and it might be an obvious point, but he bats a bit like Peterson. He is he's a child of Peterson. He extends through the offside like Peterson. He uses the crease like Peterson. He's obviously lethal on anything slightly short. If it's not hitting the stumps, then he can get his hands through it through mid-wicket, which was classic Peterson. But there is a kind of a technical... The groundwork is there for him to be able to express himself. He played one shot as well in that 80-odd, over extra cover against a medium pacer, and he just extended his hands through it and then held the pose. And that was a pure echo of that Peterson shot at Mumbai against Oja, the left-arm spinner, where it was almost done in slow motion. But because the balance is so good, you get ridiculous distance on an extra cover, lofted drive, and it went over the boundary 80-odd metres or whatever. He reminds me quite a lot of Peterson. And it would absolutely stand to reason, right? You know, he'd have been a kid at 10, 11, watching Peterson in his pomp, relatively tall, quite willowy, rangy. Naturally, you're going to want to try and bat like Peterson. There's points of difference, obviously, but stylistically, there's a big echo there for me.
The current touch point for me, and I'm not saying he's yet as good as him, but the close analogue, I think, in the current game is Suryakumar Yadav, who is vying with Joss Butler for the title of the world's best T20 batter in the world, I think. And it's because it's not just the 360 degrees thing. Like, there might well have been other players who can hit boundaries or even sixes to all parts of the ground. It's being able to do that in a reactive way, basically. Like, it's so hard to bowl to when Brook, actually without giving the bowler much of a clue, and Sky as well, it can be bowled outside or stump and they can still be getting through the leg side, or it can be you know, carve for six sort of over point rather than over extra cover. Like, you just aren't able to put a fielder there. There was also a good piece after that innings by Matt Rolley, who was in the pod a few weeks ago, talking about how the fact that he can play the scoop really aids him as well. So that throughout that 80-odd, Pakistan had to have a fine leg back because they knew that Brook would scoop as soon as they didn't have one. But that just leaves that one extra gap to hit. And then as soon as they brought the fine leg up and that final over, he nails the scoop before. There's one other thing on Brook as well, actually. Oh, this is on the selection point, which is that I know he did play a little bit of white ball cricket through the summer, but the curious thing is England's prioritisation, and we've mentioned this before, prioritisation of Phil Salt as their established next person in whatever the format, whatever the position. And it's not just Harry Brook that sort of highlighted that was a slightly curious call. And you can actually, Salt does have some things that really make him valuable. I mean, that he is very, very attacking, which England obviously really do clearly value. Perhaps you could argue they overvalue it set against other things, just such as technical ability, ability against different types of bowling, that sort of thing. And I think Duckett's highlighted that as well, obviously, who's played brilliantly as well in quite a different way to Brook. I mean, whereas Brook is, you know, it's got as many dimensions as you want. Duckett is almost, I mean, he's deliberately one-dimensional. Like, he is just absolutely ace, the sweep and the reverse sweep, to the point where he's probably one of the best players in the world of those two shots, comes in the middle overs, puts in a bowling loads of spin, and he will just sweep and reverse sweep them all day, and there's not much they can really do about it.
There's a lot of money to be made in that position. I was writing a thing on Nicholas Pooran, who is, after Gale, the best, the highest scorer against left-arm spin in T20 history. And Duckett has got that kind of middle overs spin expert quality to him. And if you can sort of identify yourself in those terms, then you can start making a hell of a lot of money around the world. He's been really, really excellent, Duckett. And as we've spoken on the show, he's another one who, coming up on the rails a little bit, but he has the versatility in his game and he has the red ball runs behind him to potentially feature in England's top three at some point down the line, in all forms.
Yeah, we said a couple of weeks ago that we can both see him opening in Pakistan. I quite like with Duckett that his first chapter as an international cricketer was kind of defined by his struggles against spin. I don't think he actually got out to a seamer as a test cricketer yet. And now he's brilliant against spin.
Just the one thing I wanted to add on the idea of Brook having been earmarked for the full lot. Joe Harmon spoke to Ollie Pope last night. Who's obviously had a great year. And I don't know, haven't heard the interview, I don't know how it went particularly, but I'd be very surprised if he didn't use that opportunity, Pope, again, to talk about how frustrated he is that he hardly hits a white ball. And you have there a cricketer whose game is very much of the modern era, but again, like Brook, founded in the principles of batting. You see the way that he runs, he's signature shot is to run at the quicks now from number three, which is unheard of. You imagine Nasser or Jonathan Trott doing that, and yet it begins to make sense, and yet he is kept at arm's length from this kind of stuff. Now, he is an ambitious young kid. He'll be desperate to be the new Joe Root. He'll be desperate to play 150 over games. It might take him 20 years to do so, but you know what I mean. And as a T20 player as well, you know,
he made a name for himself as a T20 player.
Exactly. He will undoubtedly want to be that player that ticks all the boxes. And yet, through various reasons, structure, you know, priorities, money, he's been pigeonholed a bit, you know, and that must really eat away at him, I would imagine, especially when you watch someone like Brook go out there and do what he's doing. You know, he'll be eating away at him a little bit, I think.
And I guess, going back to the new structure, he'll be someone eyeing up that April Royal London One Day Cup stint with glee. He'll be like, finally, I can show them what I can do.
Yeah, indeed.
Ben, you reckon Mark Wood bowled the fastest ever over delivered by an Englishman?
Yeah, it's been quite funny, the Mark Wood thing this series, because ahead of it, England were being very cautious, as it's right to be. You know, he hasn't played a professional game since March. The sort of what they'll kind of say is, oh, he'll maybe get a go on the Lahore leg, but, you know, you need to make sure he's absolutely fine, that sort of thing. And then he just turned up at training and is bowling faster, I think, than he ever has. I mean, bowling rockets is the phrase you have to use with him.
You don't have to.
Well, yeah, that's the stock one, at least. And then, so in his first over back, he hits 96 mile an hour. Like, wow, that's quick. And in your first over, there's no easing into it. He's right on it straight away. In the second over, his fastest ball by the speed gun was 97 miles an hour, and his slowest was 151 kilometers per hour, so what, 94 miles an hour, which is absolutely absurd. I mean, there'd be very, very few fast bowlers in history who would have bowled a ball, English fast bowlers in history, bowled a ball as quick as Wood's slowest ball in that over. And he won in the game. He got Babarat early with a ball that was just too quick for him. For the guys, you know, he has more time than almost anyone else in the world game, and he was rushed and could only, it was a top edge that almost flew for six, and the guy on the roper manages to haul it in.
And if it had gone a bit further, it would have killed someone, because they were doing an interview on the side of the pitch. Ramiz Raja was being interviewed by one of the host presenters.
Yeah.
And I think Martin Darlow from the ECB was doing it as well. And yeah, it was flying straight for him.
Yeah, and Ramiz Raja was slipping into commentator mode during that as
he
well.
It was
really, really strange moment. You have this absolutely electrifying cricket. You've got the fast, maybe the fast bowler on the planet bowling to maybe the best all-format batter in the planet.
And Ryan Darlow on comms.
Yeah, exactly.
I really enjoyed the commentary, as an aside. I know you'd have probably spoken to Butcher by the time we get to this bit on the show, as weird as it is. He's been on fire. David Gower speaks for itself, doesn't it? Oh, what a joy to listen to him.
And
Wazim and Wacker as well, you know, ticking, forever ticking. It's been really enjoyable, this series. And Ben, I owe you a... No, I don't. I never owe you an apology. But you did dare to say seven-match series... make the case for a seven-match series. And I think Joe poo-pooed it and I sort of dismissed it as well. If they're equally good sides, then it does start to actually develop a degree of substance. And yeah, I have been quite into this. You sort of said to me this morning that I can't even be bothered to watch a game of cricket anymore despite having sat through three games of cricket this weekend alone. But yeah, I've enjoyed it just as much as you have, almost.
I think the player rotation helps from an English point of view. We're seeing players we've seen a lot in county cricket, but not in international cricket, and seeing whether they can make that step
Liam
up against
Dawson.
A very good...
Why haven't we spoken about Liam
Dawson?
Well,
we haven't spoken about that last game at all, which was the best game of the lot.
Liam Dawson. What a knock.
People will have watched the game, so I don't know if we need to go through it, but that really did have people... It had proper ebb and flow. There were about four different points in the chase where you could say that like one or the other side was winning it, and that point when David Willey got out, that's when you felt the game was absolutely sewn up. That was 3 wickets in hand. You're still needing more than tens. Dawson and Rashid are both in. It was funny. The last time either of them made more than 40 in international cricket was Liam Dawson's Test debut. So although you can look at the first class hundreds and be like, oh, maybe they've got something, you're thinking like, actually, England are probably done here. And then yeah, Dawson hits Mohammad Hasnain, the young quick, for what was it, 25 in an over. Keeps the strike, then hits Harris Ralph for 4, and that's the game you think done. That's takes down to 5 needed to win, and then Ralph 2-2, and then the chaos in the final over. That was a really, really great game.
Dawson not crossing when he top edged it was possibly crucial.
Yeah, possibly.
He probably did need to play that shot with 5 of 9 needed as well. Yeah, amazing game. And Liam Dawson, always fascinating cricketer. Like, England seemed to decide exactly how good he was the first moment he played for England. And you just never see him until the build-up to a World Cup. So he'll probably not play at the World Cup. And we won't see him in England squad until the next World Cup.
Well, he's been in every... either in the squad or reserve for every World Cup in the last 5 years and never played a World Cup game.
And barely plays a game between World Cups.
Yeah, this did fully justify it. To be serious on Dawson, it's easy to talk about him as sort of a bit of a... almost a joke cricketer because of that thing. He's bowled very well this series.
Bowled really well.
He's been really accurate.
Really well.
He's really tired. In a way, he's almost the ideal bowler to Babar and Rizwan because they will be very content to knock around a spinner in the middle overs if the balls aren't there to hit, and you can at least be sure there's not many absolute filth from Dawson. Someone might at some point get a hold of him, but those aren't the two that are going to do it. England have pigeonholed him as this guy that they think if there is a big occasion and a big moment, they can entrust him to sort of step up and not be cowed by it. They've spotted that in his personality and his character. And that's exactly what last night was. That was a big moment, even if it was just a bilateral T20I series. And he absolutely stepped up and they will feel vindicated in their assessment of him.
Right, Mankad time. Whee! We've got loads of questions on what happened between England and India at Lord's, specifically on Deepthi Sharma's Mankad of Charlie Dean at the end of the game. A bit of a shame, really, as it took the focus off Hulan Goswami's swan song in international cricket. But we'll address the Mankad first. We had one listener, Paul, suggested that we're just going to get 55 minutes from Phil, which, sorry to disappoint you, Paul, is not going to happen. Hugh wrote in to say, I know you guys probably don't want to have a debate about Mankadding, correct, but I guess you're going to.
Ben does.
I just get so tired of people parroting, just stay in your ground, and I feel like it totally misses the point. The question is whether you want nail-biting contests to be decided this way, and whether a wicket is a proportionate or sporting outcome. Imagine the series is 1-1, or it was a World Cup final, or that Ashley Giles had run out Michael Kasperwicz at the non-striker's end at Edgbaston in 05. I also don't think these questions necessarily concern the spirit of the game either. The additional complexity is that a Mankad takes place after the point of release, so some deception is inherent to it. In this case, I think Dean, unlike Butler, was fractionally out of her ground at that point, but she was hardly charging down the pitch. Ben, go.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of the frustration and angst about the dismissal is an angst about the laws. It's just not expressed that way. So when people say, for example, oh, she was only marginally out of her ground, people say, well, you can be run out by a millimeter and that doesn't make a difference. I think that's people saying that, you know, there should somehow be some greater leeway for it. It's people saying that she hasn't left too early, basically. And there is an argument that they have a case as the law's written, because the law is written in a confusing, in a way that's open to interpretation, where it says that you're liable to be run out at any point up until the bowler would be expected to release the ball. Like, why would you bring sort of, you know, questions of metaphysics and hypotheticals into it in this situation? Why not just, as is with the case with almost everything else in the law, go with something actually properly factual and measurable? Like, and there are loads of options. You could say just release the ball, and then that removes all grey area, but that perhaps would give too much to the, I guess, the pro non-striker run out crowd, who, whereas the anti, it would think that actually you should be able to back up and you should be able to just kind of go, and if you're not going too early, that's fine. Or you could go with something like the front foot landing, or when the arm comes past the vertical, or there are lots of factual things you could say, and that would remove one element of it. But I think it would also help to clear up and at least put something down that says, this is too early and this isn't, rather than this sort of fudge that we have at the moment, I suppose. That's about all the energy I kind of have for non-striker runouts. I mean, it's yeah. Do you want to try and offer something?
You go, yes.
I'm very. I've always been like, it's out. You're getting an unfair advantage. The one thing I would say is India won a really close, really good game at Lords. It's their first game at Lords in 5 years, in front of 15,000 fans at the ground. And when Deepti Sharma wins a game for India, she doesn't celebrate. I think that reaction suggests there's something unsatisfying about claiming victory or taking wickets in that manner. The more I think about it, I probably would change the law to it being a penalty run, and that make it really simple. Every time you do it, one penalty run, five penalty runs, whatever. I think if you just remove the grey areas, then it would just be simpler for everyone. At the moment, it's still loosely open to interpretation.
Yeah, I can see the. I guess the other thing I would say is that
I thought you didn't have anything to say.
No, it's not about the, you know, the ethics or the moral correctness of the decision. I think it's just that whatever you feel about the debate, as things currently stand, if you are a non-striker and your bat is and you're not waiting for the bowler to bowl it before you leave your crease, then you are liable to be run out. And whether you think that's unethical or against the spirit of the game, whatever it is, it's not going to change the fact of the matter that you might well be out. And so if you are a professional sports person who, you know, and it matters a lot whether you win or lose, and that's something that people should need to train to stop doing that, basically, and that goes against and or goes without any ethical considerations. That's just the pragmatic thing that people need to understand and start doing. It's surprising that there hasn't been almost more focus on that from a training point of view. And you know, maybe some people might think that the cost is worth it, that, you know, that extra little bit that you get is not cheating. It's just you're sort of playing it's a bit of a game that you're thinking, okay, if that accumulates over time, will counteract the occasional dismissal you'll get from that point of view. But that's it's not going to change no matter what people think. I think the fight in a way has already been lost because it's in the laws and people are taking advantage of it.
I was watching it live. I felt a bit embarrassed for the game. I think, echoing your point, I didn't know where you stood on it, really. We hadn't discussed this before the show, but I feel a similar kind of reaction to you. And it's not a moral thing, it's more of an aesthetic thing, and it's more a sense of anticlimax, really, I suppose. And I think I saw a tweet or two. Twitter really does come into its own with something like this, my word. But I think I saw a tweet or two from somebody saying that the reaction of the Indian players suggested that everyone was absolutely cool with it, and that they were unified and collectively behind the move. I didn't get that sense. I got the opposite sense. And I might not have been watching it closely enough, but I got the opposite sense. I got the sense that they were very self-conscious, and they were shuffling around waiting for the decision, which they knew to be in their favour, in inverted commas. But I think there was a sense that they'd rather sort of inverted the spectacle of a finish in a series they'd already won as well, with the added text of Goswami's, you know, grand finale and all of that. And I don't know. I think in the cold light of day, there'll be a few cricketers in that bunch who would have thought, yeah, well, that's a pretty cheap way to win a game of cricket. So yeah, I saw that and I felt that, I think. I was watching, it was actually the highlights. So I'd seen it live, but the highlights were on the day after, and I was watching them with my wife, who's been a bit poorly this weekend. So she was, against her will, stuck in with me watching cricket on the telly, and obviously barely taking any notice of it. But I said to her, watch this, and what's your reaction to it? And not for the first time, I go to my wife as some kind of ethical barometer in life, you know. And her response, with no dog in the fight, was, how dozy is that? Is that batter? What's she doing? And that final clip where Charlie Dean's still looking for the ball, and she's by this point 3 or 4 yards down. My wife's response was, well, it's her own fault, right? Isn't it just her own fault? You know, if she wanders out like that, then... And I thought that was quite an interesting response, really, you know, because as I say, she's a complete neutral in this funny, quixotic cricketing scrap. Just one other final thing, from a player's perspective, and I saw another tweet from a lad who I like a lot, who's a proper cricket, club cricket nuffy type. And he said, basically, show me someone who's never played cricket without them telling me that they've never played cricket. And it was in response to somebody saying, walk out your ground, you're out, tough shit. And I get where he's coming from on this, right? He's saying, look, if you've played the game, you know that this is not cricket. But I've played the game a lot, and I would be feeling like, if I was in Charlie Dean's shoes, I'd be feeling, after the emotion dissipates, I'd be feeling, yeah, I've let myself down a bit there. Don't put yourself in that position to be mugged off. And it's up to Deepti, sure, to do the mugging, and many cricketers wouldn't, and I personally wouldn't, but don't allow yourself to get mugged off, I would say, on that one.
The last thing I'm going to say is, I don't think you can just dismiss how strongly so many players feel about it. You know, if current international players, Stuart Broad, for example, Jimmy Anderson, Sam Billings, feel moved to comment and show that they disagree with it, I don't think you can dismiss that. If the people
but that's not the prevailing opinion of professionals. If you'd watched Sky yesterday afternoon, Atherton, Ward and the brilliant Tamal Mills all essentially echoed the same pragmatic point of the other, i.e.
if you've you step given out your ground,
then you've got to face the consequences.
It's also a cultural thing.
Tamal Mills was particularly good on it, I thought, actually. And you know, the brouhaha around it all. The position of Stuart Broad and others is not necessarily the prevailing one.
That's true.
It's also probably quite an English debate as well.
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, I think those are the... I mean, obviously it was England versus India, but those are the people I've seen speak out about it. It's nice to see them tweeting about the women's game in any case.
Do you know what? I thought that. Oh, okay. Interesting, are we?
I would actually... there's one more thing that I could maybe say. And I feel similarly about this to fake fielding as well, which that there is a possible way that this could be. I mean, this isn't going to happen overnight, obviously, where this actually becomes almost an exciting part of the game. At the moment, in the laws... leaving your ground early is phrased as cheating, essentially. Like, umpires should be docking players 5 penalty runs if they're doing it, which never happens. I've never seen it happen. But there is a stealing the run law in there. But why not just allow for players to steal a run? And by doing that, you sort of make it into a tactic in a way. Like, you, especially in the last overs of the T20, when actually that can be when the, like, you know, you're almost sprinting in with the bowler. You're sort of going for that. That thing there, and then what you would need to do for that is you would need some sort of deterrent to the bowler to not kind of go for it every time. Like, if a batter sort of does runs and then stops and the bowler goes to run him out, then it could just be the same punishment as it is for a bowler breaking the wicket in their delivery stride normally, which is a no ball. I think that could possibly work, and I think it could potentially be quite fun to see, you know. In baseball, stealing bases is an accepted tactic in the game, and it can be quite an interesting, intricate part of it. And why could that not be the same for this? I mean, it won't happen, but that would be my preferred solution. And then it wouldn't feel so cheap because there would be skill to it, I think. It would be not just a sort of a very, very rare sort of almost like get out of jail free card. It would be something that is accepted and you know, have pros and cons to doing it as a bowler, I guess.
I love the smell of hypocrisy in the morning. And you mentioned Stuart Broad, you know, everybody's favourite cult hero. The king of shithousery, right? The reigning emperor of shithousery. His pedestal is untouched and will be, and hopefully long may he reign. But this notion that, you know, running straight through without even turning to the umpire and celebrating a wicket, nicking it to first slip and standing there and just adjusting his helmet is all part of the fun of cricket. But this, which is incidentally totally within the laws and legit, this is a step too far, and this is worthy of the deepest opprobrium. I just find that amusing. I find that very amusing and very, very English and very, very cricket.
On things that are amusing, there's a funny moment in the Rachel Hayhoe Flint final that took place the next day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
also
the moment
at Lords.
This is the moment
where Dean, I think with her second ball, yeah, appeared to give a warning to the batter when bowling, and they hadn't left their ground at all. It was like a nice reaction.
Pure
from
class,
the crowd as well. Yeah,
it was great. Yeah, and I guess one of the things, and it's a shame, it seems like it's turning ugly now, but in the immediate aftermath, the reaction from the England players and the India players was mostly sort of England frustrated but accepting it.
Dean shook Sharma's hand
exactly
straight afterwards.
Yeah, whereas now, and fear that I thought this would kind of be the last day of it, and that would be, but now it's kind of getting a bit uglier with Deepti Sharma on her return home saying that they'd actually warned Charlie Dean several times, and Heather Knight, who wasn't playing in that game, but saying that she was lying about that, yeah, that Dean wasn't warned, and saying in that India won legitimately. She's not disputing the dismissal at all, but if you feel confident in it, why, in her words, why feel the need to lie about it? Obviously Deepti Sharma said she's not lying, so that may well continue on a bit.
Yeah, and that would be a great shame, because you know those two teams rely on one another. They've developed a really good rivalry over the last few years. It would be a shame if that's tarnished. And it would be a shame as well if a few newbie cricket fans walked away from Lords that evening with a slightly empty feeling, having been really absorbed by a really interesting back and forth game of cricket. And if you have walked away thinking, oh, that was a bit naff, then who wins there? Nobody wins, really.
Just on the Hayhoe Flint final, amazing game. The Diamonds beat the Vipers by just 2 runs with Lauren Winfield-Hill continuing her excellent form, scoring 65 for the Diamonds. Ben, your moment of the week is from that series, but wasn't in that game from Lords.
Yeah, well, Harmanpreet Kaur played an absolutely incredible innings to win the series and to win the second game. It was the perfectly paced knock. It was 100 off exactly 100 balls. And then was it 48, 49 of her last 13?
I think it was 43 off 11 after reaching 100.
43 off 11, that's right. And it was just the way she was, in a way, it was, as we were talking about Brooke and Surikuma Yadav, there was that same element of 360 degree play in this, in that, you know, whatever England tried, Harmanpreet Kaur had an option to find the boundary on one or other side of the wicket. Really felt for Freya Kemp, a 17-year-old on her ODI debut, tasked with bowling to the batter who, when they're in, is probably the most destructive women's player in the world. And she bowled really well through her first 8 overs. I think she was maybe one for 38 wicket with the final ball, that 8 over. And then ended up with the most expensive figures ever by an England women's bowler in an ODI. And yeah, I mean, let's focus on Harmanpreet for the moment, because she's actually had a brilliant year, having had a rough time of it since quietly in the past few years. So since that 171 in the 2017 World Cup semi-final, which is maybe the you know, the best innings ever played by a women's cricketer, she hadn't passed 60, I think, in an ODI. So she'd been struggling, but she's been brilliant this year. She's got 200s. She's averaging, I think, 60 odd. So she's been really, really good. And she is, there's no one better to watch, I think, when they're in full flow. It's almost, there's almost a cartoonish nature to it, I think, in that, like almost like like anime in a way, in the way that her arms, when she extends through it, it's almost as an elasticity to it in a way. Like there's a huge backswing and a huge follow through that's like seems exaggerated, but obviously she can time it still ridiculously well with that. She is incredible to watch. She's just a brilliant cricketer. But England really suffered from a dearth of leadership, I think, in that game. Amy Jones obviously steps in as captain, not had a great series as a leader, and then beyond her you had Kate Cross in the squad, I guess, who's a senior player. You've got Tammy Beaumont there, and then beyond that you've got Eccleston.
Eccleston seemed like to be doing quite a lot of the captaincy.
Yeah, and when you've got a 17-year-old who's, you know, struggling, you just need someone to put an arm around the shoulder, and there wasn't, and to say this is fine, this is sort of you'll get through it, this is the plan for right now, and there didn't seem to be that. And so it's been a tough series, been a sad way for the Lisa Kightley tenure to end, but also possible to see it coming, because England do have lots of very young players, not just youngs in their early 20s, but players in their teens, and there are going to be bad days for them. And if you don't have the seniors who can sort of who can take the team forward in those situations, then that is a tough position to be in, I guess.
Moving on, Surrey are county champions for the 21st time. They beat Yorkshire at the Oval last week, while Hampshire lost to Kent, meaning that Rory Burns' men won the championship with a game to spare. We talked about them a little bit last season, but they just come at teams, they bat deep, have millions of bowling options. They select all-rounders over specialists. Amar Verdi is the obvious one, who can't get a game for them at the moment. Jamie Smith played for the England Lions over the winter. He was often left out in favour of all-rounders. They had 11 different centurions, and that's not including overseas all-rounders Colin de Grandhomme or Aaron Hardy or Jamie Overton, who nearly scored a Test 100 this summer. And as we mentioned earlier, whenever the England guys were away, they had youngsters coming in and stepping up. Tom Laws, 19-year-old all-rounder, was excellent with bat and ball whenever he came in. Cameron Steele came into the side at the end of the season and bowled a couple of ripping wrong-uns in the game against Yorkshire. So very much worthy winners.
Yeah, brilliantly conceived win all round. And obviously, sure, the caveat, they've got money, but they've still got to use it well and right. Dan Worrell is a serious bowler at that level. He's an international class bowler. Certainly would have been 2 or 3 years back. Comes in hard for them. And they, as you say, do have an interesting way of going about it. You know, they have Jordan Clark, who's possibly could easily sort of be their player of the year. It will probably be Will Jacks, but it could easily be Jordan Clark. He comes in there at 7 and 8. He bowls heavy balls and whacks it. And you look at that side and you get them 4 or 5 down. And this has happened quite a lot this year. Somerset almost beat them twice and went down by 3 wickets both times. Essex almost beat them, wrapping the game at the Oval. They went down as well. You get them 5 down and then they come again. And as the ball gets soft in county cricket and the third and fourth choice bowlers are not obviously quite as potent, Surrey they attack at that point. It's a very interesting way of doing it, really. They've had to weather the loss of Folks for large parts of the year, of Pope, of course, injuries here and there as well, and they've come out there and just been relentless, really. Fair play to them. And fair play to Gareth Batty as well, you know, who has been an advocate for spin, has been an activist for spin as well, saying, you know, urging teams to play spinners. Well, he's found a way of effectively circumventing that, using Will Jacks as a useful spinner, and he's emerging as an international class cricketer. But they've done it really, really well. Fair play to them. And I'm not calling up a dynasty yet, but you would think as teams, players are funneled ever more towards teams with real strength in depth and the finances to back that up, you can see them becoming a force for a number of years now, I think.
Handy signing of Dom Sibley over the winter as well.
Indeed, yeah.
It was interesting, I was looking back at old Gareth Batty quotes of what he said about spin, and you can almost interpret it as not just give spinners a chance, but he just really doesn't rate how players play spin. And I think that must come into why he's back Jackson Steele, that he thinks that you don't have to be this super polished spinner in county cricket to actually be reasonably effective. Obviously, not as good as the specialists. It's quite interesting.
Hampshire ran them close, you know. They had a brilliant year, a real nearly year, really, for Hampshire.
Massive result at the bottom of the table, Kent beating them. It means that Warwickshire are in huge trouble. They basically need to beat Hampshire to even have a chance of staying up. And obviously, with them winning the championship last year, having a number of really established, excellent county championship players in there, them going down will be quite a big deal. And especially next season, if you basically don't have a chance of being in Division One the season afterwards, when it goes to the 16 division, if you get relegated this year. So that's massive for them.
But again, what that tells you is that there's not much wrong with that top division, the competitiveness of that top division. There's very little wrong with it. And so we move to three banks of six, with trepidation, I think, because that first division is broadly competitive from top to bottom. Northants, you know, they'll survive and survive relatively comfortably. They'd have been stick-ons to go down at the start of the year, but they've found a way of doing it. Teams are hanging in there and being competitive from top to bottom, and you can, as you say, win it one year and be virtually relegated the next. That's the beauty of that top division. I don't think it necessarily needs to be condensed for that competition to retain its integrity.
In Division 2, Glamorgan's David Lloyd scored a triple 100 in their side's win over Derbyshire to keep themselves in the promotion hunt. Notts, who are top, played Durham this week, Middlesex in second are at Worcester, while Glamorgan in third are at Hove.
Do you hear a good stat about that David Lloyd triple 100?
Go for it.
So it made Glamorgan the first ever county side
to have a quadruple and a triple?
Just two triples in the same season.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Yeah. That is a very good stat.
That is good, Ben.
And finally, Ben, in a minute, tell us what's happened in Australia, India.
Oh, yeah. Well, we covered... we covered the first game last time. The second game was in Nagpur and was the first game to be played there in a little while, and was quite frustrating because there was a big delay for a patch of wet outfield, even though there'd been no rain in the day prior to that. So they ended up having to play sort of an 8-over thrash, which India just edged Australia in. Matthew Wade again did some finishing nonsense. And then the third game, you had Cameron Green hit the fastest T20 or 50 by an Australian not named David Warner or Glenn Maxwell. And then India chase it down with Surikim Yadav, who we've already talked about, the star there. Kohli made half century, which got quite a lot of praise in the aftermath, but was close to being one of those where, like, the game was a lot closer than it needed to be, but a very, very good series, and both sides well
10 seconds.
Moving on from the series, the thing with Cameron Green is that he's not on Australia's T20 World Cup squad, and as per the IC rules, there's no way to get him in there unless they hobble someone.
Boom. Done. Very, very good, Ben.
We were talking about it before we started the show, but I think it is weird that the teams have to name their squads so early when there's not that much high-level bilateral cricket played in the 12-month cycle, and there is a lot between World Cup squad announcement and the World Cup itself. That's weird. And finally, Nick asks, what predictions did you make at the start of the English summer, and have you been proved correct? Phil, you've done a bit of digging in the old magazines to see what you actually did predict.
I can't remember what I said yesterday. None of us predicted Surrey in the magazine or on the podcast. Joe went for Hampshire. I went for Lancashire. You went for Essex. Jim Wallace went for Essex. Ben, I don't know, but he wouldn't have gone for Surrey unless he did. I got a number of things wrong. Jamie Smith, who did make a double 100, but I said that he'd be like a breakout star of the year for Surrey. Thought he'd open the batting, didn't. Batted five, made a double, not much else. As you say, couldn't get in the side towards the back end of the year. That was wrong. I said Oval Invincibles men to win the What's It. They didn't do that. I said Welsh Fire women to win the What's It. They didn't do that either. So broadly wrong.
Are the What's It's the new sponsors next year?
Yeah, very good. Very nice. But I was right on the test team. I said they'd win the first lot 3-0. And I said they'd win the next lot 2-1. So I was right on that one. And I said that Ollie Pope would have a starring role. So I was sort of right on that as well. But slim pickings.
You could say I was wrong. I was right on the test team, but really I was wrong. I thought that England would struggle when they have. I thought that, you know, the new captain, new coach wouldn't solve the old issues, which I felt were still there. And you know,
well, how can you present that as right?
I was right for about 2 days at the end of the.
But that's not right. Then, well,
they also bowled New Zealand out for 100 on the first morning of the summer.
Yeah, and I would have at the time said that the bowling was fine, not the issue, and they'll bowl okay, okay in English conditions, and the batting will still struggle.
For the first 2 days of a triumphant summer, you don't edit that out.
I'm definitely not.
That is ludicrous.
Well, no, but it was just at the end of the second day, I was feeling relatively smug. I was like, oh, this.
Remember Taha as well, once of this parish, R.I.P. He also was very much in that camp as well. That, you know, the same problems still exist. England are going to go down against the New Zealanders. Blah 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 blah. You.
Well, I can only really remember two predictions, which probably means I got all the other ones wrong. So the two ones I think I kind of got right were, I thought Harry Brook would have the kind of season which meant he won't ever play county championship cricket in April again. Obviously, the county championship might never be played in April again because of Royal London Cup being moved there. But more than I thought that he'd get an IPL deal. And I think we kind of know that he will now. And the other one was, I was pretty early on Matt Potts, maybe not at the very start of the season.
Yeah, you were very, that's very true.
I thought he'd have a good summer. But those are the only two predictions I can remember, so I probably got everything else wrong. Anyway, that is all we have time for. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Ben. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll be back next week for our end of season show. Podcast Network.